Now the talk is about to begin. We have Aidan Cullen with us, who is working on effective computing, robotics, and hardware, but not really security as a main issue. He will be presenting his talk on hacking the RP2350 and also how the process was done and what avenues there are for further bugs to be discovered. So please give a warm welcome applause to Aidan.
All right, thanks everyone. I'm Aidan, and I'm here to present about Raspberry Pi's microcontroller, the RP2350. So Raspberry Pi introduced this as a successor to the very popular RP2040, and they introduced security features with this new chip, which weren't present on the 2040. So they seem to be targeting these commercial and industrial customers and trying to move into those sorts of areas. Despite starting as a sort of maker-oriented product, a microcontroller very popular with tinkerers. So they've added more SRAM. They have many of the same peripherals. It's essentially an evolution of that chip. So my first impressions of this chip, it has some quite unconventional design decisions, I think. One of the notable things is this core swapping architecture, where it's a dual-core chip, and you can choose whether you want to use the ARM cores or the RISC-V cores, but each core essentially gets put into a socket, so to speak, by the multiplexer. So you get to choose between one or the other, ARM or RISC-V. So this introduces some challenges for them in terms of managing that processor selection, as we'll see later. For the security aspects of this chip, it was... and Raspberry Pi says it will double your fun. I'm not sure if it will double your fun. It may double your chances of making a mistake. So Raspberry Pi has had this audited to some extent for security by a few people experienced in that area. I'm quite new to that area myself. So they started a hacking challenge at DEF CON to see if anyone could find a flaw in the security of this chip. And then that challenge was extended after it ran for a month to the end of this year. So now it's the end of this year, of course, and time to solve the challenge. So the goal of this challenge is to read out some secret that's loaded into the OTP, one-time programmable memory. So you can only write this once, and in this case, they program this secret coffee into it. It could be in real life some key that your application doesn't want the user to see, for instance. But the OTP memory has a lock mechanism, which then the challenge code sets up so that this page 48 can't be read out by non-secure code. It enables the secure boot features, so only signed code can be run by the bootloader. It enables the glitch detectors, which are an active countermeasure against fault injection techniques. And it disables debug, of course. And so the challenge sets the chip up in that way. So when I'm attacking this challenge, this is my first time trying a hardware-based security attack, I sort of looked at how I view the dependencies of all these aspects of the chip. At the top, you have the management of permissions. So that relates to the locks of the OTP, which only allow it to be accessed by secure code. There are other permission settings that work similarly. That relies on being able to distinguish between the secure and non-secure worlds. And those secure and non-secure worlds are really established by the boot ROM. So when the boot ROM starts up, it needs to make sure that it only loads signed code, runs that becomes sort of the secure code, and then the non-secure world is separate. The ROM uses this fancy redundancy coprocessor, which isn't really relevant to this talk, but Raspberry Pi is really trying to ensure the integrity of this ROM. And to protect the ROM further, they rely on those glitch detectors, that active countermeasure, disabling debug, and also ensuring that you can't use the RISC-V cores. Because the RISC-V system is not meant to be part of this security architecture. If you debug the RISC-V cores, you get full privileges on the bus, on the chip. So they have to ensure that RISC-V is disabled. Now, all of that depends on configuration, which is stored in that one-time programmable memory. Of course, when you get the chip, it's not secured in this way. The glitch detectors aren't turned on, debugging is allowed, and so on. So those configurations have to be set in the OTP. So my first impression here is, if you can somehow get the OTP to incorrectly read out those settings, then you could just have your secure chip act as non-secure. So that seemed to be the simplest and most powerful thing to attack first. So I started looking at what are these critical configuration bits, as they call them. The first set of bits is in this row called crit1. Now, a row in OTP is 24 bits wide. That's sort of the word size of this one-time programmable memory. So this includes things like the bit that controls those glitch detectors that I mentioned. It contains this debug disable bit, which will turn off all debugging. Secure debug disable would only turn off secure mode debugging for the Cortex M33s. And then secure boot enable also has to do with that RISC-V disabling. And there's a bit more to that, as we'll see, as we'll discover later. The other set of bits that's important is in this crit zero word. Now this, they don't mention in the data sheet, they don't say this, but my impression is that this is programmed at the factory essentially as a way to fuse off cores that aren't used. So if they ever made a chip that didn't have one type of core or the other, they would set it in this register. You're not meant to be able to change this. But these bits are quite powerful in terms of the low-level hardware, those multiplexers. So when the chip starts up, when does it read these critical bits configuring the security? Well, it has what's called a power-on state machine, and these are the states that it goes through. This is for the entire system. So the chip comes out of reset, and one of the first things it does, they just label as OTP. So the OTP block needs to come out of reset and read these critical bits. Now, to do that, it has a state machine of its own inside that block called the OTP PSM, the OTP power on state machine. And that has a number of its own states that it will go through to read these bits before proceeding with the rest of that process. So the first thing it does is it runs this boot instruction, and Raspberry Pi doesn't tell you much about what this is. They do tell you that Synopsys is the company that provided this OTP block that they're using in the chip. And this is like to check if power is good. So it reads some certain location 16 times and sees if that succeeds. Then you read out those important critical bits in crit 0 and crit 1. Then you read out the hardware keys, which are used, for instance, if you wanted to lock debugging until a certain key is provided. Then it reads whether the hardware keys are set as valid, and then it reads out the page locks. So those are all the controls for who can access what OTP row, depending if you're secure or non-secure. So we really are interested in this crit 0 and crit 1. Those control the security. Now, Raspberry Pi also has another trick up their sleeve in this OTP, something called guarded reads. So there's a limited amount of info about this in the data sheet, but it's this additional consistency check that they're trying to do. And initially, you don't know much about this. We'll see more about this later. So once that process has finished, those states that I just showed, the OTP block has read crit 0 and crit 1, and it packs them into this register. So this register, just called OTP critical, gives us a window into what that state machine thought was stored in the crit 0 and crit 1 words. So we'll use this later to see what's going on when we're trying to attack this mechanism. This is the block diagram that Raspberry Pi shows for the OTP. And if you're like me, this is one of the most interesting parts of the datasheet, because this diagram is in a totally different style than everything else. It has some mystery stuff in it, like there's this signal right here, which you almost can't read, but it says force magic word. Like, what is force magic word? You know, they told us that Synopsys provided it, so, you know, the SNPS is an abbreviation for Synopsys. Like, here's the lock, you know, here's that state machine I was telling you about. But a lot of things are a mystery. SBPI is like a specific interface which is used for programming this. And then one thing we see here is this ring oscillator. So the ring oscillator clocks the PSM, and this ROSC and PSM system is supposed to be a little self-contained machine responsible for reading those critical bits. So if you search up more information about what you saw in that diagram, particularly the SHF name, which is on that actual OTP storage, you find this company called Cydence. So they were based in Canada and were acquired by Synopsys, and they did a lot of design of this anti-fuse OTP. So it's like a fuse, but it closes when you blow it instead of opens. That's why it's called anti-fuse. So Cydence is the company that actually designed this, and you can find a lot of diagrams online that match up with the blocks that Raspberry Pi showed. So they have this similar integrated power supply, which was also in Raspberry Pi's diagram. They have the SHF core, and then they show this access port, which is used, you know, to manage the readout of data and programming of data. The cool thing that I was interested in here is this power supply. Writing to the OTP requires some special programming voltages. So this power supply gets some external power rail, has to come into the chip. It has, you know, I believe, charge pumps and various sorts of regulators for producing these fancy voltages that the SHF anti-fuse array needs. And I was particularly wondering whether there's a special read voltage needed. Because if, for instance, there's some way we can interrupt the power to this anti-fuse array while it's reading, perhaps we can affect the read data somehow and mess with those critical bits. So, you know, this doesn't give you all of the answers. One way to get more answers is to look at the chip itself, and particularly what's inside the chip. So you don't have to do this, but I had the chip x-rayed, got some images of the die, and this is kind of a fascinating step so that you can actually see what we're going to be attacking. So this is what the chip looks like at the top metal layer before the metal layers have been removed. And after you strip the metal layers off to get down to the silicon, the chip looks like this. And so then I annotated this with what I think the blocks generally are, all the major stuff. And there's quite a few interesting bits here. The one part to point out is just at the bottom. This is likely in this blue sort of spaghetti logic in the middle, likely where the main processor cores are around, because they would be fetching code from the cache for the Quad SPI flash that it reads code from the boot ROM, and from these fast SRAMs 8 and 9, which are faster than the other larger SRAM blocks. Then at the upper left is what we're interested in with this OTP. So even if you don't have experience looking at chips like this, which I didn't, there are structures you can use as clues to really easily identify what some things are. So there are 24 of these column-like structures here. And of course, the bits may actually be in a different order, but this is a good hint that that is actually the OTP memory right there. And by just reading online, you can hypothesize what some of the other blocks are around it. I'm particularly interested in this power supply over here. Now, if you look at the metal that's on top of this, just kind of in a fainter way, the power supply block is still underneath there, and you can see the bond pads at the top of the chip. Now, there's this one in particular, if it'll highlight, which there's some metal, that would be metal layer 7, below the top aluminum redistribution layer, which goes straight down to this integrated power supply. So this seems like a good indication that this OTP's power supply is just directly supplied by this pad right here. There's no additional circuitry in between. There are not glitch detectors. There's not any nonsense on this power supply. We can directly access it, I think. And we'll also make a note of this pad beside it. This is on the USB PHY. And if we zoom out, we can see that these two pads are actually both bonded with two bond wires to the same physical pin on the chip, and that's USB OTP VDD. So this pin, 53, is responsible for supplying both the USB PHY, and it's directly connected with another bond wire to that integrated power supply. So this is a good indication that if we mess with this power supply externally, we will be directly affecting potentially what's used by the OTP memory to read out the critical bits. So I wanted to be able to control this power independently. On Raspberry Pi's Pico 2 board, that pin is actually part of a copper pore which connects to all the I/O pads, and you couldn't solder something to it independently. So you could make a custom board. I chose to cut this copper pore in between the two QFN pads. So that's what that looks like. This is not too difficult to do if you have a sharp craft knife, and you can cut the copper just in between the pads like that. And so then USB OTP VDD is isolated, and once you resolder the chip, you have this nice trench in between the pins. Now this capacitor here is for decoupling those two pins originally. Now I don't have any extra capacitance on USB OTP VDD. So then I just chose to probe it using one of these sharp spring probes, so you can easily swap the board out. But now I can inject whatever voltages I want into that power supply and see how the chip reacts. So the setup that I, before the setup, I did this on two boards. So one of them is locked down with debugging disabled and all the challenge protections in place that Raspberry Pi wants, and the other I left unsecured. So I'll be swapping between them as I need, depending on what I want to see. So the setup I used for this is also pretty simple. I know there are many more sophisticated fault injection tools out there. I just have essentially a simple oscilloscope measuring the current into this pin using this current sense amplifier device, the microcurrent, which Dave Jones designed. And then just a J-link or any other debugger you might have to check, do we have debug access, what's going on. And I'm just using a normal 3.3 volt digital logic pin as the power supply for USB OTP VDD. It's so low current that that's the simplest way for me to supply glitches or whatever waveform I want to it. And then, of course, the run pin is the reset pin, essentially. So you toggle that to try again, reset the chip. So this is what the setup looks like. And the first thing that I wanted to check on with this setup is the current waveform that you see when the chip is starting up. How much power is being consumed by that block while it's running that state machine? Because maybe that'll let us know what it's doing. So this is what that looks like on the oscilloscope trace. And if we zoom in a little bit, add the scales. So the scale on the left is microamps. So it ends up sitting, after this finishes, just below 100 microamps on USB OTP VDD. And there's all this stuff occurring, of course, in around the first 600 microseconds after the chip is starting up. So this is on a non-secured chip, which still has debugging allowed. And if you run this multiple times, it doesn't change much. There's not much variation. If you switch to a secured chip, now the secured chip, this also doesn't change much. It's roughly the same. However, you'll notice the secure chip does it a little faster than the non-secured. That would just be because its ring oscillator happens to be a bit faster, just because of variations in the manufacturing process. It also seems to consume a little more current. I'm not sure why that is, just seems to be variation. But there's no huge change with a secure chip. This state machine seems to be doing the same thing. So let's take a closer look at this part. We know what the state machine is supposed to be doing. So in that part, we can see there are these spikes here, and there are actually 16 of these groups. Each dip in here is between, if you count them, there are essentially 16 groups of spikes. And that corresponds to those 16 initial reads that we know it's supposed to do in order to check if the power is good. Then this part here, which is looks quite a bit more dense if you zoom in, it also has spikes which are much more closely packed together. And this, you can hypothesize, is when it's actually reading out all that meaningful data, the critical bits, the debug keys, eventually then the lock settings for the OTP words. And after that happens, you can see the tail end of it there on the left, after that state machine finishes, the chip eventually goes into the boot ROM, and it does some additional reads from the OTP in the boot ROM. The interesting thing about these is they vary a bit, and that's intentional. Raspberry Pi has that redundancy coprocessor, which adds variations in instruction latency. So if you zoom in a bit, you can see there's even more variation. And it does, for instance, a sequence of 8 here. The rest are groups of 3, so it's pretty clear to see. You can correlate that to the code in the boot ROM easily if you want. So I tried doing some glitches and seeing how it would respond. So this is just a 10 microsecond pulse, and I'm just arbitrarily choosing somewhere to put it. If you put it in the middle of those 16 initial reads, they just start up again right after. So this process here is essentially just shifted over to the right, and after the glitch has finished, it just goes right back to the first of the 16 reads to check power, and then proceeds as normal. So these 16 reads seem pretty robust. I can't really trick it. It will always restart itself if I add a pulse in the middle of those. Sometimes, if you put your pulse in the middle of Raspberry Pi's reads in the state machine, it also does a similar restart. It finishes up something here, and then right at this point, around 550 microseconds on this chip, it goes and just restarts the whole process, does the 16 check reads here, which look like that, and then does all those longer reads. Now, if you just try it again with the same parameters, sometimes it doesn't restart. If you're in this long region over here, sometimes it doesn't restart. These 16 initial reads always restart. So what's going on here? Have we like broken something? This is a secured chip that I'm testing with now. So let's try to connect the debugger. You can't connect a debugger. It fails in the same way. The chip is locked down. There's no like easy progress like that. This is the debug topology of the chip, just sort of as a reference. On the left here with the ARM cores, this is what we're trying to use right now, and we can't because it's disabled on the secure chip. So to figure out where to glitch, how to glitch, we have to use some better tools if we don't want to just keep guessing. So I essentially created a tool which is just a simple Python script, but I'm going to sweep the position of this pulse through the entire 600 microsecond range of this, and in this case, at every 100 nanosecond interval, I'll just have it try that 10 times, and we'll plot and see if at any point the debug becomes available, right, on this locked down chip. Well, the debug never becomes available. No matter what offset you have, the debugger fails to connect. You know, so I just let this run for hours and then plot it. No luck. So how can we learn more from this point? Well, one way we can learn more is just try to do this on a chip that isn't locked down, that we can connect the debugger to, we expect to, and see if we're affecting anything that we can inspect about the system once the debugger is connected. So the things that we can inspect about the system when debugging is allowed are on the left here. So I already mentioned that critical register, which is where we can see what that state machine thought was stored in the OTP crit 0 and crit 1 rows. It will also tell us what it thought was in the key valid parts of OTP, and it will also tell us the status of the lock registers that control the secure and non-secure access to OTP. So the first thing that I plotted is, well, does debug always come up, because we should always have debug on this non-secured, not locked down chip. And the answer is actually it doesn't. Sometimes you fail to connect the debugger even though this chip is not locked down. So we're going to have to look more at that. There are some times when you can connect the debugger but you can't read any registers from OTP. This just seems to be random, seem to have confused it, somehow confused the bus, and you get bus faults. And then we also get situations where the values have been modified in these registers. So these are successful indications that we're affecting the contents that the state machine is reading with our glitch. And from the location of this green slant, you can hypothesize that this last section is where it's reading out the locks for the OTP rows. The little green mark here is where it reads the first bits of key valid. And the reason that we wouldn't be able to connect the debugger in this range is because if we glitch over the higher bits of key valid, those keys happen to be used as debug keys. So if you don't provide the right key, you don't get debug, right? So it thinks that we've locked out the debug if we overwrite those bits of key valid. So that's why the glitch breaks debug there. But on this non-secured chip, why does the glitch break debug here? We don't know exactly why yet. So we're going to focus on that part. So I just put a pulse of 50 microseconds at around that position, at 250-ish microseconds. Now, of course, this varies depending on what board you have. So you either have to, if you wanted to do it yourself, you'd either have to try a range or look at the current trace to position it in the same place. But you try to connect, and it still fails, but something is different, or it fails just like it would if the chip was locked down, but something is different in that particular point where we placed this glitch. We get this APB AP with address hex A000. Now, if we recall from the debug topology of this chip, there's an interesting thing at that address, A000. It's the access port for RISC-V debug. And we're supposed to be in the Cortex-M33 mode. We're not supposed to have RISC-V here. So yeah, we've somehow managed to get RISC-V to show up using our glitch. So the question is, what happens if we do this on a secure chip? Because a secure chip is really where it would be a problem if RISC-V shows up, right? Because the RISC-V system gives you full bus privileges if you connect the debugger. It's not supposed to be part of secure boot. So I had my automation read out what debug access ports are available and plot it just like we did before. So this is on a secured locked down chip, and indeed there are little periods of time where if you place the glitch there, this third access port for debug shows up, the APBAP, which is for RISC-V. And this is a problem because you shouldn't have RISC-V on a secure chip. So let's try to connect the debugger, right? And it connects successfully. So yeah, the So the RISC-V cores were supposed to be permanently disabled in this situation, or permanently, as Raspberry Pi says. But as we found out, permanent involves reading these bits, and we've apparently messed something up. So we can indeed connect with GDB, and that secret that they had, we can just read it out. You can read anything you want. And of course, the challenge code, which is ARM code, it's not running because it can't, because the M33 cores have been multiplexed out. So you really just have a blank canvas and you can do anything you want in this situation, since you have full privilege. These bits here, if you are wondering, are the ECC for error correction and so on. So why did we get here? Well, we can read out that critical register, And we notice that it has these threes in it. It says 30033. So what is that? Well, this is what the critical register looks like. So we'll go through that again and put those bits next to it. So this pattern of threes in each nibble, each set of four bits, it sets the two upper bits, or sorry, it clears the two upper bits and sets the two lower bits. So starting from bit zero is set, bit one is set, two is clear, three is clear, and so on. So the most interesting thing is we've set both ARM disable and RISC-V disable. Now, so both should be disabled, right? No. Well, the way Raspberry Pi's logic is set up, this means that you get RISC-V, because ARM disable has higher priority, and they tell you that in the data sheet. I don't know why they chose that. I mean, they chose it. And then the other things that we have are secure boot enable is still set, and secure debug disable is still set. The reasons we don't care about those are that secure debug disable only matters for the Cortex-M33, because RISC-V is not meant to have this secure distinction with trust zone. So as long as debug disable is clear, which we did manage to clear using the glitch, then we're going to be able to access RISC-V debug. And likewise, secure boot enable doesn't really matter, because as long as we have the RISC-V cores selected and debug disable is clear, we'll be able to connect the debugger to RISC-V, as we saw. So the question is, where did these threes come from? I mentioned that notion of a guarded read at the beginning that Raspberry Pi mentions in their data sheet. So this is a very zoomed in view on an unsecured chip, so that we can dump this data, of that plot that I showed you earlier. So as we advance the start of the glitch, we go through these periods of time where the plot is blank and nothing interesting happens, and then these periods of time where we either lose the debug or we get modified values in the OTP. So what are these gaps? Like, what is this pattern of stripes? Well, this guard read mechanism essentially intersperses reads of this data, threes, in between every meaningful read that the state machine does. So this is meant to check if you're messing with the power. The idea is that if you read these threes and that data is correct, and then you do a read of some important critical security bits next to it, then you validate that those critical bits are correct because the guard read passed, so to speak. And there are guard reads between every meaningful read of data that it does. Now, the problem with this, and the reason that we're getting threes in our actual data, is that if you drop the power out just after guard data has been latched, just after the guard data is read from the OTP antifuse array, then apparently any subsequent reads still read that same data until the power comes back on. So essentially you carry forward this latched guard data into the meaningful reads that you're doing. So then so this start of a green block would be where the instant where the guard data is latched, and then the instant where the green block ends and our glitch starts to fail is where we have read real data from the OTP array, and then if we carry that forward using the glitch, then it causes a subsequent guard read to not match the threes, and it restarts, and you don't get anything interesting. So this pattern is this interleaving of meaningful reads and guard reads. And so Raspberry Pi is apparently unaware that there's this persistence behavior, where if you drop the power out momentarily for a glitch, you don't read all zeros or all ones or garbage, you keep reading the last thing that you read. And this is not necessarily a problem, because, for instance, if you were reading two different bits of guard data, or like inverting it and checking every other, then you could sort of avoid that. But if you read the same guard word of threes in between every meaningful read, well, you know, we can just turn the power off and have all the reads be threes, because that was the last thing that got latched. So one extra step beyond just reading the secured data from the OTP and solving the challenge that way, if you wanted to single step through secure M33 code, for instance, there are actually mechanisms in the chip that let you, from software on RISC-V, move to debugging the Cortex-M33. So this is actually really easy to do, because there's a register called debug-en for debug-enable. And despite what the state machines have read at startup, you can set bits in debug-enable to turn on the debug hardware manually. And the way you get this to persist across resets is basically by triggering a watchdog reset that starts at that second step of the power on state machine. So this debug N essentially overrides any secure debug disables that the OTP state machine has read. So you just do this simple thing, you know, the chip resets, and then when it comes back up, you can connect your Cortex-M33 debugger and you get secure debug enabled. So that's kind of everything you can ever want. At this point, you know, you can single step through secure code if you want. That's kind of it for that point. Now, Raspberry Pi tried some mitigations which would have stopped this sort of attack. The guard read idea is good in theory, but they seem to have a fundamental misunderstanding of how this OTP works. It has this persistence behavior, right? Where the data sticks around when the power gets dropped out, and so their guard data of threes gets carried over into meaningful data and sets the critical bits in a convenient way for us. The other thing that they tried was to randomize that ring oscillator. They mention in the datasheet that this oscillator is supposed to have some randomness added to make it hard to time glitches, because it's just an internal clock. But as we saw from all those plots with the really clearly defined bars of where the guard is happening and where the meaningful data read is happening, this randomization either doesn't exist or it's too small to be significant for the purposes of that glitch. It turns out that each read takes somewhere on the order of 10 clock cycles, it seems to me, of that ring oscillator, which is the ring oscillator is nominally 12 megahertz. So you only need to be able to time your glitches to that sort of 10 clock cycle interval. Maybe they have randomization on individual clock edges of the ring oscillator, but that doesn't matter for this. The security features that are irrelevant are basically everything that happens later on in the boot process. So the glitch detectors were a very cool idea to try to prevent fault injection attacks, you know, leading to issues with the clock or issues with power, but they don't have glitch detectors on USB OTP VDD. The glitch detectors are just on the core voltage rail. So the glitch detectors we just don't care about, and of course we saw from the images of the chip that we just get to mess with the power that goes directly into this integrated power supply for the OTP. They also have the redundancy coprocessor, the RCP. Well, that only has to do with the ROM code, and we've already won, essentially, before the ROM code even runs by affecting how the critical bits are read. So, you know, Raspberry Pi, I wonder, they could potentially use the RCP's randomizer in the OTP, because as we saw, the RCP in the boot ROM, when it does reads from the OTP PSM, when it does reads from the OTP, those actually do shift a bit in time. So they have working randomization there. So there are a few interesting things to learn. Raspberry Pi is using a design from a third-party vendor, so originally Cydence, and then later Synopsys. And if you look at info about Cydence online, of course they have patents, they mention this mechanism of protecting against power issues by doing guard reads. And one of the things that's in there that you can find is this idea of doing one read, then later doing some other read of different data, and then perhaps you transform, do some logical transformation and compare them and see if they match, rather than using the same data every time. So the original designers of this OTP memory, they probably know that it has this persistence behavior, and the persistence behavior may be fine as long as anyone doing this sort of guard mechanism knows about it, but Raspberry Pi apparently has somehow missed this persistence behavior. Of course, it's also possible that the persistence behavior isn't intentional, but I think the persistence behavior probably has always been there, and Raspberry Pi is just not quite understanding this. And yeah, so I think when they're mentioning permanent in the data sheet, you know, it's easy to think that when something is disabled or something is permanent, that it's just some instantaneous mechanism. But in reality, there's a ton of complexity going on behind the scenes just in something as simple as whether debug is turned on or off. There's this entire state machine with an oscillator and, you know, someone at another company. It was involved in designing this whole anti-fuse architecture, and there is just so much engineering detail behind the scenes that you really have to be aware of if you want to fully understand your secure system. And as we see with, I think, this and many other fault injection scenarios, there are many ways to influence random signals on the chip. You know, if there's a signal somewhere that would turn back on your disabled cores, well, you know, someone may eventually find a way to flip that. And I think that's pretty much all the details of that. One notable thing about this, I think it's not a very difficult attack at all, right? If it's just a normal power glitch, it just happens to be on USB OTP VDD. So I think, you know, you need to remember to glitch in places they don't tell you to. There was this board with, glitch here on the core voltage. Well, in this case, the core voltage is not the place to glitch. Yeah. So you have to try random ideas somehow. And I'm new to the hardware hacking arena relatively, but I think it's a great place to try creative ideas. And I will probably at some point release, if you want to look at the full resolution pictures of the chip that I had, or my annotations, or the code that I used for those plots, I'll release that at some point. Haven't gotten the time to do it yet, but I would probably announce if I do that. And yeah, that's coming to the end of the time, so I think we could take questions.
Excellent. So those of you in the room, you can start lining up behind the microphones, and I will ask the signal angel if the internet has any questions for us while you line up.
There are no questions yet from the internet.
Thank you very much. We have a question from microphone number 2.
Yeah. Hi. Thanks for the great talk. I really have lots of inspirations for attacking the next silicon revision. But about the debug enable and watchdog reset thing, does the existence of that mean that, you know, if I take over the software that's running as an application and get code execution, and then poke those registers and do a reset, does that also mean I can, you know, read out all the OTP stuff because I have a debug?
So the debug and register, I have to check. It may be that I don't recall if it's that you can't access it at all if you're in the non-secure world. I believe, I have to check on that. Because, yeah, essentially, they wouldn't want to allow non-secure code on the M33 to hit debug N and then reset the chip. Because when you reset the chip, that debug N register is essentially stored in the always-on power domain. So even if you reset to the point of the OTP, you retain that value, which then overrides debug disables. So yeah, I would have to check on that. I don't remember exactly off the top of my head, but in theory, they have it figured out correctly. You know, they don't have any glaring flaws like that. Yeah, sorry, I don't have that off the top of my head.
Okay, thanks.
And we have a question from microphone number one.
What were to happen when Raspberry Pi adds a diode from the glitch detector supervised power rail to the USB OTP power rail inside the die?
So you're thinking if the USB OTP power rail drops, then you would supply it separately inside the die. I mean, certainly that could be a way to fix this. You know, if they add some kind of power supervision on that USB OTP VDD, they could probably fix this. Of course, maybe there are tricks to defeat those sort of glitch detectors. I haven't looked into it yet, but certainly if they added that, you would be fighting with a glitch detector, that active countermeasure, and it would probably be much harder to get away with these glitches. But you know, it was overlooked.
We have a question from microphone number two.
Hi, I was wondering how you managed to reboot into ARM, given that, as you stated, the OTP have been read and they are not changed after you reboot through the watchdog. So since in the OTP you select which CPU should boot, how you were able to reset into ARM by then?
So at that point I'm using... At that point, I'm using a chip which is supposed to be in ARM mode, right? In the OTP, it's supposed to be in ARM mode. And when you glitch it, it's incorrectly in RISC-V mode because it incorrectly read the critical bits. So if you trigger a reset and then you don't run your glitch, it's going to come back up in ARM mode because it's going to read the critical bits correctly from the OTP.
Okay, so they're being read again from the bits, so it's not that they stay the same in the second register where they copied into.
So when you do that watchdog reset, the OTP state machine runs again.
Okay.
Yes, because when I configure that watchdog reset, if you look at the data sheet, you tell it where to start the reset. So you can start it from essentially cold, and it would clear the debug EN register, or you can have it start it from the OTP state machine. So it runs the state machine and reads the correct bits from the OTP, but that enable register for debug is still set and overrides them. So that's how that works.
Thank you very much. And we have microphone number four, and then we have at least two more visible questions. So please, if you have questions, please get up to the microphones. Microphone number four, please.
Hello, thanks for the talk. And I may have a very basic question, but you mentioned that you were glitching for 10 microseconds or 5 microseconds. So how did you end up figuring out how long the glitch should be?
So that's something that in this situation is not very critical. I chose 5 microseconds for those long plots just because it seemed like a reasonably short period of time. It was just chosen arbitrarily. In this case, if you keep the power off for a long period of time, all you're doing is filling reads with threes. So to actually exploit this, you don't need to care very much about how long the glitch is. As long as you position it just at the start, where we saw those first red bars vertically, just at the start of that big dense series of reads that the state machine does, you can keep it off for anywhere from like 10 to 200-ish microseconds, and you'll be fine. Because you're just overwriting like the hardware keys, which you don't really care about anyway, for like locking out rows or locking out debug. So I was mostly choosing it arbitrarily.
We now have, I think, about 6 questions in the room, and I think if we have short questions, we'll be able to make all of them. Microphone number 4, do you still want to ask your question? No? Then microphone number 5 in the back.
You mentioned that you're relatively new to hardware hacking. I was wondering if you have some recommended reading for people that want to make the jump from software to hardware.
I don't think I have recommended reading. I suppose I saw this challenge and really just tried it with what I had. Certainly, there are a lot of really skilled people working in hardware hacking, like the amazing presentation earlier today on those Apple Type-C controllers. And so I think you can probably find many of those resources on the internet, just watching what people have been able to achieve and trying similar things. So I had heard in general, you know, that you could do these sorts of power attacks. But then, you know, as you saw, I used just rudimentary sort of electronics lab equipment. I'm not using sophisticated tools for glitching. So I just sort of decided that I wanted to try dropping this power out based on what I found. I suppose I would say just, you know, the internet is a great place to learn. Conferences like this are. And when you have a challenge, it's really your own creativity that gets you the farthest. If you're only used to trying one approach, you know, like only glitching on core of power supplies, you know, maybe you get stuck in that mindset and you forget to try something else. So I think, you know, being new to an area like this can be a benefit in terms of coming up with new ideas, you know, starting fresh and seeing that something else is the best to focus on.
Brilliant. We have a question from microphone number 3, and then we'll go to microphone number 1 afterwards.
Thank you for the talk. I was wondering if God values didn't overlap with the values that we wanted, would there be a way to still control the critical values?
So in this case, we are getting lucky, and Raspberry Pi is getting unlucky, that the threes happen to set the correct bits, or happen to set a good combination of bits for us to get debug. If they had chosen, for instance, to have RISC-V disable be higher priority, then we would have never gotten this. Or if they had rearranged things such that the debug disable bit was bit 0, then the 3 would have gotten us all debug disabled for us. So there's not a way I know of to write arbitrary data. There is some amount of luck in the fact that this guard data happens to set the critical bits in an insecure state. If you time the glitch just right, I believe it may also be possible to write all ones, just due to some tiny little edge case where I think you turn the power comes back on just as it's in the middle of a read or something, and because of the sort of analog aspect of how the read happens, you may be able to get all ones. I believe that shows up in some of my data from those plots. But apart from that, I don't have a way to write arbitrary data. Here, there is some luck in the fact that Raspberry Pi had the bits in those places.
And all the luck goes to microphone number 1.
Thanks for the great talk. I wanted to ask, because you used the voltage glitching, if you can do similar things using EMP glitching, and if these EMP glitching attacks get detected by the glitch detectors, or if they also only detect the voltage glitching?
I haven't tried attacking these glitch detectors that are on the core power supply, so I'm not sure how they would react. I think I just don't know enough about the EMP glitching because I really haven't researched it. I guess from what I heard, people can even target it at specific areas of the chip. So perhaps you could try to target something like that just at the OTP without upsetting the glitch detectors in the rest of the chip. Or maybe you would have a hard time with it accidentally triggering them. I'm not sure. That would just be something you'd have to experiment with, I suppose. Or people who have experience with those EMPs might know.
Okay.
Cool. We now have a question from microphone number 3, and then Signal Angels signal to me if there are questions from the internet.
I have just 2 really short questions. Like, how did Raspberry respond when you like showed them? And the second one is, would a simple fix be that they simply go to the default being the ARM and not the RISC? And do you think they can implement that easily, or is that like something that they cannot change on the fly? I don't know, firmware update or something like that.
So I suppose I'll answer the second question first. This is something that's baked into the state machine reading from OTP, and it's not even related to the ROM code. So they do have to make a new chip to fix this, you know, a new revision of the chip. they can't just change the ROM code and fix this because you know they've already lost before the ROM code runs. So I don't know how much hardware change is really necessary for them in this OTP logic. They could get away with just fixing this immediate problem by like flipping the priority or doing something simple like that. There could still be other opportunities that people find to get around that. Maybe there is some way to get more arbitrary data into it other than just the threes. I think a better thing for them to do would be to make some more fundamental change about how these reads are guarded. You know, put some monitoring on this power supply, put a diode, those sorts of things that aren't maybe as quick. Yeah, perhaps they could make a quick, cheap fix. I'm not sure if that's the best thing for them to do. Yeah, I don't know enough details.
And how did they respond?
Oh, how did they respond? Yes. So I reported this to them essentially in, that would be September. So they were happy to receive it because, you know, I think at around that time they received sort of a flurry of submissions for this challenge. So they seemed happy to receive this. I don't know exactly what their plans are, but of course after the challenge ends, I'm sure they'll say something. They were initially, I guess I was initially unsure how to interact with them about giving this talk. You know, they wanted to mention everything sort of in January about this vulnerability. I thought the Congress here was a nice place to present this. So they agreed that it would be cool to present here. And so yeah, I'm happy that they offered the challenge. And I think they're really trying to have a good relationship with these sorts of security research projects.
Thank you. It was a great talk.
We might still have a question from microphone number one. Nope. Any last questions? Then you should be really quick. If not, I think we should give Aidan a big round of applause for his talk. Thank you.